another edition of The Exchange presented by Confederation Group. As always, I'm Sam McPhail, joined with my co-host, Blake Doyle. How are you today, Blake?
Boy, I'm great. I'm very great. I mean, the weather is good. The legislature's in. The economy's booming. Why could we not be great?
Oh, I don't know. There's a couple different reasons. Yeah, like we just talked on, the big thing in the news this week is the legislature's back in for what I would call an emergency sitting, I suppose. And we actually had a guest on who lives and breathes politics this week in Stunipi.
More than you.
Yeah, more than me, yeah. More than the politicians, maybe. You know, but Stu, we kind of just went over what he expects for the – this was recorded before the House actually sat, but we go over what he expects of this sitting and maybe what going forward, whether there's collaboration or not. And I'm not sure what your take is on that, Blake, but it doesn't seem
collaboration. No, we've talked about this a few times, Sam, and I think we're both certainly in agreement, and that's been proven now that the era of collaboration ended maybe as long as 6 months ago, but certainly it's over now. That was, if there's ever a question, I mean, I think the leader of the third party, I love saying that third party, you know, was trying to get some headlines. He had a commentary in The Guardian, but you know, even the opposition party Greens are losing some patience, I think. And there were some interviews after the first session of the legislature that really, I think, was telling as far as how involved some of these members were in discussions. And, you know, if I was governing, why should they be terribly involved? You're trying to make decisions. You've been elected to make decisions. And, you know, there's a perception you're going to collaborate. I don't think that maybe government has a great intention, really, even to do that. And that's all kind of coming to a head. So that's my sense. I don't know if you feel differently, Sam, but collaboration was a great concept and it bought some time, but it's not practical. This environment's not the right place.
I don't think so either. And I think the biggest thing too is there's so much pent up, and Stu talks about it more in-depthly in our interview, but just there's so much pent up kind of energy and frustration the past 10 weeks. And yes, of course, the Tories did have a lot of good policies moving forward, but then there was a couple that were kind of, you can see the cracks coming up and some things falling through. But I do think...
What are you referring to something? What are you, you're kind of being very veiled. What are you suggesting? Was there something that happened that I missed?
Oh, no, I'm sure you didn't miss it. But I think that was, and it was evident in question period the last couple of days too about the cottage goers, allowing non-residents to come back before we actually allow maybe New Brunswick to come home, to come across our borders or and other people. But I think that's kind of what did not resonate well with voters, and it was clear the past couple weeks. But I think that it'll even come out further in question period and in the legislature the next couple of days.
Yeah, and they've only got a couple of days. Like, I think that was certainly a misstep. It was an abrupt decision. Certainly the public sentiment, from what I've observed just from talking to people in the community, is against that policy, rightly or wrongly. You know, we do have to open the economy, but I think a more cautious approach, maybe if the statement was, we're going to look at doing this in July, and, you know, that would have bought some time. Kids could have gotten into kindergarten and sports. There's a lot of things that haven't happened for local islanders before this kind of policy pushed forward. But anyway, you're elected to govern. You got to make decisions, and they don't always, you know, as the premier said, not everybody always likes every decision, but that's the job of making decisions on behalf of all islanders.
You aren't even allowed to play rugby this summer, so mad that cottage goers aren't allowed to come?
And well, you know what? Rugby? Honestly, I'd like to talk to Stephen Myers about this. I'm not sure that maybe Dennis King didn't specifically target me by canceling rugby, because it's a small group of sports that aren't allowed to be for participation, and there's no COVID here today. Maybe by opening up this border, I should be upset that that's going to limit my ability to play rugby, but that is a disappointment. I've been getting fit, I've been training, and I'm just going to have to go smash into trees or something.
Yeah, now you'll have a whole other year to get even more fit. So there's no excuses that Lee Reed can't put you on the first line.
Well, there is no reason for that. But other than I don't know how many years I have left to keep trying to do this. So
fair enough. But in terms of, like, you talked about how the Liberals definitely gave up on the collaboration, but the Greens yesterday and today in question period for that matter are stating a lack of a shocking failure to show leadership. So they think that Premier Dennis King is essentially passing the shot on to and blaming others for what's happened. Like he won't take kind of the full on leadership. He's saying, okay, no, this is this minister is in charge of this. This minister is in charge of that. It's not my specific avenue. But when you're premier, you're in charge of everything. You can't just pass the buck to whoever you feel like.
I don't know. Has he been passing the buck? I'm not sure. You think he's taking responsibility for his actions? He's speaking well in the House. They're pummeling with questions, and he's, deflecting questions. I think he's not getting right to the point, but I think he's doing a good job. Is, of question period.
No, I know. I think I'm just spitting out the Greens rhetoric. This is not my specific. It sounds like you're pretty good buddies with them, though. If you're
look, I'm not coming up like that. I'm not coming to anyone's defense. I will give him credit only because he did deflect the questions. I think the Greens came at him pretty hard. They started with a nice, gentle softball, then they just went right for the jugular. Rightly so. That's what they need to do. And I don't think he ever answered any of the questions. The Greens didn't follow up. They should have pinned him to a corner, and they didn't. And he deflected very effectively. So not choosing sides or sticking up for anybody. But that first showing was, I think the Premier did show pretty well in a difficult. There's no win on that conversation, yeah, other than the Greens didn't follow up for the kill.
We won't talk a whole lot more before the interview, but one thing that was kind of, and I wouldn't say it's shocking because he's done it in the past, but MLA for Monique Kilmeade, Corey Deagle, started peppering his own caucus colleagues in the health minister, James Aylward, just saying that throughout the whole COVID situation, they kind of forgot about the opioid and fentanyl issue. And whereas that's kind of the silent killer because COVID-19 is taking over the news streams, and that they weren't reporting the opioid deaths or overdoses over the past couple months. So I think Corey Deagle is never one to not, like, he likes kind of, not that he's muddying the waters, but he wants real answers. He doesn't want just a softball to his caucus colleague. He wants to kind of get the nitty gritty out of him.
You know, I don't think I've seen any backbenchers get this much airtime or assault ministers so directly. It's, and I'm not sure if it's a walking wounded that he's attacking the Minister of Health or if it's a diversion from the bigger issues, such as the, allowing cottage goers into the province. If it's a diversion, it's a good strategy because it probably worked. If you're hammering a minister in your own party, I'd say that's a pretty questionable tactic. And it's not the first time that we've seen that. So interesting. I'm not sure how this is all going to sort of shake out. This is a short session. They'll have to come back again, for another conversation, introduce a budget. I'd love to see a longer debate to see how these relationships are really coming out. That was interesting. I don't know. Have you seen anything like this before, Sam?
Well, not in my time. No, my young time in politics, or my little time in politics.
Well, what do you think of it? So, if you haven't seen it, what do you think of that tactic?
I think it shows that Corey Deagle isn't just going to be pushed aside. He wants to be heard, and he's a new MLA. He's a young MLA. And by doing this and kind of pushing back his own government, he will kind of create a brighter future for himself as an elected official because he stands up for the riding issues, whether it's the Kings County Memorial Hospital or the people that are dying in his riding of opioid overdose.
He's probably bulletproof in his riding now after a few of these, but he's not getting airtime without being given permission. So somebody's allowing him to speak disproportionately with other backbenchers. And he's very articulate. He's a great MLA, and he'll be a great future minister. I wonder if he's going to be a minister sooner than later.
Yeah, you never know. That might be something to keep his mind off his issues. And then one more thing I guess we want to touch on is just the overall fact that the Greens, they're always considered the kind of, I don't know, maybe they're willing to collaborate. And I think that was, like we said earlier, that was just kind of a way of kind of getting in agreement and getting their foot in the door. And now that they have their foot in the door, they're able to open it up and criticize where they see fit.
Well, and you have to in opposition. I mean, I think it's important to move collective interests forward. And I think any party would do that to some extent. But your job, especially in question period, is to criticize. And as much as a minority government might like to collaborate, and I think it's a good thing, it's probably the only way to survive, it's probably the wrong arena. It's like a rugby field. I mean, you can get along after the game and you can beat each other up when you're on the field, but this is a field of play and there's got to be some tension and aggression and a few shots, even some maybe that the referee doesn't see.
So no shortage of politics in this week's episode and in the news cycle in general this week on PEI, just due to the legislature being back and due to there being some kind of heavy-hearted issues being brought forward and that have come up the past couple weeks.
We should. So Stu Neatby, we're really delighted to have him on. He's a contributor to a whole bunch of mediums. He's on CBC, he's on radio, he's on obviously the political reporter for the Guardian newspaper. And it was great to have him. I feel like we've got a new band. The three of us could maybe harmonize again on other issues. This is the political aspect is a portion of what we really invented this podcast for. And we haven't had a legislative sitting since we initiated this. So it's great to start to talk about politics, the impact on Islanders, and to have great voices like Stu Neatby on here to, share his perspectives.
Yeah, for sure. And I think, like he said, he was even willing to come on again, and maybe we'll do some sort of a political segment every so often with Stu. I'm sure people would enjoy that because he is kind of the the one with his ear to the ground on a lot of the issues, and he's around the politicians the most. But yeah, we will turn it over to an interview with him to get a little bit more on his background and what he's seen the past 10 weeks, or maybe even closer to 11 weeks during the COVID-19 phase. He's known by many for his various stories and kind of keeping us up to date on the news from the political world. We're here with Stu Nepe of The Guardian. And thanks for coming on, Stu.
Thanks, guys. It's a pleasure, actually.
Now, I know when you first arrived back on PEI, some people were wondering what Prince William was doing in the back of the legislature. So tell us a little bit about how you, that was a reference. I heard that somewhere on Twitter.
Does that mean my hairline? Is there a reference to my hairline there, Blake?
So give us your path from an islander who's gone to journalism, and now here you are at the legislature.
So I guess like a lot of people in sort of the millennial Gen X mid-30s period of their life, like I'd sort of bounced around Canada doing different jobs. I took like international development studies and economics at Dal, and then I spent some time in the labor movement in Ottawa, and then ended up for the longest period of time pretty much just working like in hotels, like hospitality industry. So room service, spell, like carrying luggage and like these 5-star kind of hotels and restaurants. And that was really my first, what I'd say, real job, like a real kind of middle-class job, was actually kind of working in the hotel industry. So, I did that for about 7 years, I think. And at a certain point I just sort of decided, hey, like, you know, I'm still relatively young. Maybe I'll give this whole journalism thing a go. I'd sort of thought about it back when I was in university and decided to go back to school out west, and got a job for a small town newspaper up in northern BC for a little bit, and then this job here at The Guardian opened up. So I came back as basically I still am kind of a rookie, like cub reporter kind of thing. So, but you know, don't tell anyone.
You've got a pretty important portfolio as far as managing, although it's not as busy these days. Last year you've only met 8 times, so, but managing the legislative portfolio is an important one for PEI.
Well, here's the thing. I mean, yeah, it's like really busy when the legislature's open, but political reporter, you got to basically know you got to be on top of everything. So it's, you know, it's agriculture, it's fisheries, it's a lot of healthcare, education. So it's sort of like you're kind of jack of all trades a little bit, but basically it's like I have never run out of stories. Like the thing that keeps me up all night is just things I don't get around to covering that are really kind of important that should be covered. So I'd say it's been pretty busy.
So as far as the journalist kind of vocation, it's changed a lot. You've seen a change a lot in the time that you've probably just been on PEI. Mm-hmm. How do you manage so many different portfolios and so many stories and the tight timelines and still remain current? Like, I know there's a lot of vehicles. You're on CBC, you're on political panels and the radio. You mm-hmm. tweet very, you know, consistently. How do you manage all these platforms and still get a message out that people can digest in a print medium?
I don't know if I'm the best at that, to be honest. Like, I mean, my approach to reporting is like, I don't focus on being the fastest. Like I try and just do my best to get, like, to try and cover as many angles of the story as I can. And to be perfectly honest, like sometimes that means that, like today, a story that I'm kind of working on, another outlet sort of gets it first. But I kind of think that there's like an appetite out there for people who want, like, not just the like quick, like the 5-paragraph thing, but they want to know, like, you know, a couple of who are the players and like what the interests are and like, you know, a couple of different perspectives. I try and focus on like focusing on an issue and, you know, getting a good bite out of it. So that's what I tend to do. Other than that, yeah, I think it's just like trying to talk to as many people as I can, you know.
There's no shortage of perspectives either on PEI. Yeah, I'm sure you've
made that connection. Yeah, no, it's nonstop. Like, the funny thing is that like I was actually worried before I came back here. Like I was working in Prince George, British Columbia for the last daily up in northern BC, and that was an insane news town. Like, you picture kind of a logging town, but imagine there's like this highway called the Highway of Tears, which a lot of First Nations know is like basically this highway where tons of First Nations women have been murdered over the years, right? like, so you had crazy town politics, you had tons of like crime, the drug trade had basically taken a hold in the town. Great outdoors sort of activity. Like, it was a great news town. So I was actually worried when this job came up that, like, wow, this is not, I'm going to have a lot less to cover if I go back to PEI. Like, it's not going to be as like newsy. So yeah, I mean, I was surprised. I was like completely wrong about that, but.
And what about, so we're coming into the legislature. It opens up this week. You know, it's a very different environment. Anything that you have observed over the past year that you think is kind of unusual to what you would have expected? And more importantly, what do you kind of expect to see happen in this legislative setting, which could be fairly short, I think, by many people's expectations?
I think the biggest thing that's going to change is sort of, and this sounds wonky, is the tone. So the story of the Dennis King government so far has been almost like, I mean, like optimistically, you could call it like the optimism of this whole collaboration thing. You could also call it a gimmick, you know, like where he's you know, the type of government that's reaching across the aisles and trying to cooperate with the Greens and maybe the Liberals a little bit. So I think we're at the point where that as a brand might start to wear a little thin for King. And I think it's partly just because of pent up frustration that's sort of just coming out of the pandemic, like a lot of pent up issues that I think both opposition parties have kept a lid on. That's just going to come out. I think it's both the Liberals and the Greens, you know, they got a bit of a chip on their shoulder. They're trying to prove themselves. The Liberals, of course, they don't like the fact that they're in third party. They don't like the fact that the Greens bested them in the last election. The Greens, meanwhile, are probably not the happiest that anytime they do work with the government on legislation, they never get any credit for it. So I think you're going to see a more of a return to an oppositional style from the opposition. But I don't think it's the end of what we'll call kind of the collaboration process.
Yeah. And I think just during the honeymoon period too, the year after the election, it's hard to do anything wrong. Not hard to do anything wrong, but it's there's less of a foot on the lid. Like you said, there's more of they keep a lid on things because, all right, we'll see how it goes. We'll see how things work. But after the year's been up, and also throw a pandemic in it, the people are, like you said, frustrated, and they want to be heard more than they have been in the past.
Yeah, I mean, credit where credit's due. Like, this whole sort of, like, ethos of Dennis King of being like, I'm so sick of being so sick and tired, like, you know, the whole, like, I'm so sick of old-style PI politics, like, it was a good plan. Like, it was a good brand that sort of got him the leadership of the party. It extended into the election about a year ago. You know, he's sort of a bit of a fresh face. He's coasted through, I think, two legislative sittings for the most part. And it's durable. Like it's a little like ephemeral. So it's not 100% a solid thing. Like, there's no real coalition government, right? With the Greens, like, there's no signed agreement, but still the Greens can credibly say that they have brought about legislative change by being part of this sort of sometimes cooperating, sometimes criticizing thing. So as a strategy for a government, it's a good one. Like, it's sort of stood the test of time. And, you know, usually by a year in, you start to see like some cracks start to, you know, wear on a government like this. And, you know, here we are in the middle of a pandemic and King's probably still polling like probably above any other premier in Atlantic Canada.
Do you want to kind of talk about maybe through the first couple weeks, kind of the very intense weeks of the daily, sometimes twice a day announcements that with the Premier, Dr. Heather Morrison and Cabinet. Do you want to kind of run us through that a bit, what that was like?
Yeah, it was weird the first week, because I don't know if people remember this, but like, you remember that first week when it was actually declared a pandemic and like the only representative was Heather Morrison. And we found out, I think it was like the week ending the 13th of March, before we had the first case of COVID-19, and it was because everybody was out of the province, you know, like Aylward had been on that recruiting trip over in Ireland. Dennis King had been on a family visit, turned out to the States before going to a first minister's meeting. The finance minister, Darlene Compton, was in the Dominican Republic. So like, so it was a sort of weird week where like there was no government, you know, like I think, you know, other sort of reporters, we were sort of asking like, well, where, you know, what happened to everybody? So I think that was a bit of a slip up. Like, I don't know if you can necessarily fault people for having taken some vacation time at that point. Maybe they could have predicted that, like, that would have been the week where the pandemic hit. Maybe not. People certainly have faulted James Aylward for not, not self-quarantining. But, you know, the week afterwards, I think they really sort of got into gear, from quarantine space. So the relief programs were rolled out very quickly. And I think I've said this before, but I think Matt McKay sort of comes out in this period as sort of the star of the cabinet, of the King cabinet. And it makes sense. The guy won the biggest plurality of any politician in PEI. He got the most sort of vote leads of anyone. So he knows what he's doing. But I think at that point, the response was to get programs in place before, like, while you were waiting for the federal government to put the bigger programs in place, like the CERB and the wage subsidy and, you know, the student program that's been put in place. And, you know, I think they pulled it off. Like, I was looking for people who were falling through the cracks at that point. Like, I was actually just trying to reach anybody who relief hadn't reached or were ineligible. And I eventually found them, but that in that first phase, it sort of seemed like there was a program for almost anyone to tide them over for that time being. So yeah, I think that sort of period sort of lasted fairly well up until maybe towards the end of April. And that's when you started to have the opposition talk about the fact that we were the only province who hadn't had a legislature that had met. I think it was sort of the period where, you know, we were starting to see some of the people who were not eligible for the CERB benefits. And there were a few cracks that were sort of starting to show, but it really wasn't until, I think, you know, this past week in May where, you know, the some of the restrictions started to be loosened where I think there was any real criticism leveled at the King government. So
you see that, is that going to intensify, do you think? Because it has been very harmonious. There have been cracks. Sam, you know, that the third party, what do you call the office of the third party or base from the legislature? I mean, they're still trying to select a leader, so they're a little bit sidelined. Are people going to be coming, and it's hard to come after blood coming through this COVID. We're going to be in this COVID situation for maybe a couple of years. Like, is there going to be some aggressive tone, or is it just going to be a few sharp edges on a still collaborative environment?
From a crisis perspective, essentially opposition parties just have to keep their mouth shut and let government govern until they can look back and say, you should have done this, you should have done that. Trying to criticize during a crisis situation, like right when it happened in the last 10 weeks, you're going to look like you're going to put your foot in your mouth and just look like an idiot. The idea of that, the crisis creates opportunity. It happens every crisis that someone will benefit, and usually it is the governing party because they can look like the good guys or give out benefits or whatever the case may be. So, for example, Premier King and Prime Minister Trudeau, free money is what is on the face of what people are thinking they're getting, and that free money resonates with everybody. If you're getting money in your pocket or find $20 in your jeans, you're going to be happy.
So until you have to pay for it.
But that's for now, it's free money. And then maybe in six months or 12 months, we can look back and say, oh, they should have done this a little differently. And I'm thinking that the King government's realizing that with the cottage goers situation right now is that how could they have worded it differently so it didn't look like rich people with a second home can come in, but I can't go visit my family in Nova Scotia. So I think they have obviously regretted the wording a bit, but how would I have done it differently? I don't know. I think there's just had to be somewhat of a gentler ease into the communications of it.
Where did that come from, Stu? Like, that's a big issue.
Well, so yeah, okay. So I guess if you were the biggest critique, which is really easy for us to do in hindsight, that I guess you could make on the government is that they were really quick to react, but weren't necessarily planning, you know, in kind of a more medium or longer term way. And so this comes to some of the stuff that you've been raising, Blake, and about the. And I've also been reporting on about the Premier's Economic Recovery Council. Honestly, I think that the decision around long-term seasonal residents, so I do think it had to do with the tourism lobby. I think back at
in late March, seven tourism associations wrote to Matt McKay just demanding like dates. Like, when are we going to know when the travel restrictions are going to ease with Nova Scotia and New Brunswick? When are we going to know if Ontario, Quebec is on or off the map? When are we going to know whether the national parks are going to open? You know, like, just can you give us anything so that we know that our industry is not going to totally, you know, plummet, you know, this year? So I think the seasonal residence was the thing that was sort of thrown to tourism operators as it's something that the province could do itself without having to rely on other provinces. And the one thing, if they changed, I think might have made it less of an issue would have been like that it was tied to a second home, which wasn't necessarily what the tourism operators were asking for. They just wanted some sort of plan for long-term residents to come and maybe be quarantined but let in, not necessarily tied to like a second home. So I kind of wonder if, you know, it's a great what if hindsight kind of thing, but like if that had not been how it was phrased, whether it would have been quite as big of an issue and whether people would have freaked out as much as they had.
Yeah. And that's the thing about communications and even media. You can't really, once you do something, it's like putting toothpaste back in the tube. You can't roll it up and hope it happens. And I like, even from my perspective, I've noticed that whenever you put a government announcement out or give out money or do whatever, you have to kind of resonate with the lowest common denominator. So whether mm-hmm. that's the lower, like people in poverty or like, and I'm not saying any offense to anybody, but there's a scale on PEI and people with lower IQs, et cetera. You have to resonate with everyone. You can't just resonate with the people who make $70,000 a year. You have to SB with all levels. And that's why I went back to my kind of free money analogy that everyone can relate with free money. Not everyone can relate with seasonal residents who live in New York or Ontario or wherever the case may be, that they can come home and do whatever they want while others are suffering and barely paying their mortgage or barely paying their rent.
Yeah, for sure. But I mean, like, I think it was less about there being pressure from seasonal residents or a possible charter challenge or any of that stuff than it was just about like, you know, the one concerted sort of industry pressure I saw, like it seemed that like retail people, restaurant people, like they had their meetings with government officials and like, you know, they were okay with the uncertainty. But the one concerted pressure area, I think, you know, the one group of people who I think were a little bit more pointed in criticizing the King government were the tourism operators. And so you kind of had the government sort of lean a little bit, you know, because that was a pressure point. And as a result, they sort of, I just don't think they expected the amount of backlash that they were going to see from that. So, I mean, legit, like they do have a point, right? Like, I mean, we are looking at if there's not some more revenue from even like 1,000 more people who are seasonal residents, like you do wonder what kind of long-term damage is going to do to like mom and pop operators for the 2021 season.
So this issue, like, it's really the first misstep I think the government has made, certainly through this whole pandemic crisis. Is this going to be a chain, do you think, right through the election? Or is this, you know, going to smooth itself away? Do you think the opposition party is going to latch onto this as the first kind of gaffe that we've seen in the last little bit?
I actually, on Friday, I think I thought this would sort of dog the Dennis King for a little while. But then, you know, Friday, of course, he had that press conference where, you know, he revealed in, you know, after a question from Ocean 100 that like RCMP had come to his house, you know, like in a bit of a misunderstanding. So like I think that sort of blunted a lot of the public anger a little bit. I think it's still out there. Mm-hmm. But yeah, no, I don't know. I think it will kind of blow over a little bit. It'll still be around, and I think you'll probably still have some petitions, but I don't think the online anger is going to be as visceral, especially if they actually come to an agreement with New Brunswick around easing the restrictions between PEI and New Brunswick.
You know, if you look at the U.S., how much things have opened up, and you look at how we're trying to maintain such a restriction, this virus will come back, I think. We'll be ready for it in the fall. Mm-hmm. But if you don't open the economy a little bit, it can have longer term consequences. Go ahead, Sam. I'm sorry, I kind of cut you off there.
No, yeah. You're good at that. I think, and like we said, like, there was a lot of misconception because, yes, it said June 1st, they're allowed to apply June 1st, and then there's a waiting period. Yep. So realistically, we probably wouldn't see them till July, but people read the headline, and that's it a lot of times. And I'm sure you, as a as someone who produces those headlines, you know that people don't read the whole story. They just judge on what they see on the clickbait on Facebook.
Well, and I got, so here, you know, here's the part about being a boring journalist. It's like, I can see it from the government side. Like, they had to do something for the tourism operators. But the problem with this announcement is that it wasn't a real announcement. Like, normally they put out a press release where there's like, here's the rules. And there was no, there, like, I, you know, sent an email and asked, like, okay, guys, like, what are the rules? How do people apply as a seasonal resident holder to, you know, come in? And they just didn't release any details beyond what King said, you know? So there's not really anything out on paper as to how this is supposed to work. Like, you know, like if someone doesn't have family in PEI, but they pay like Shaw's cottages or whatever to quarantine them for 2 weeks, is that permitted? And there's like no answer to that stuff yet. So you could tell, like, from that, from, like, the fact that the New Brunswick Premier, Blaine Higgs, didn't seem to see this coming, that it wasn't executed, like, the tightest that it possibly could have. But, you know, yeah, like, so, obviously, like, there's a lot of reasons you kind of see why it sort of blew up a little bit. But I think it was just, like, yeah, the government has, you know, gotten quite good at reacting quickly, but in this case, I don't think it did them too many favors.
So, Stu, you mentioned another announcement without any policy density behind it, and you referenced this a moment ago with the Economic Council. So this is something that I've been intrigued with. I think it was announced end of March, early April. Mm-hmm. It's kind of a vacuous sort of, I guess, board. In fact, I've heard that the board was established. I've heard a number of names that have been on that Economic Council. I don't think anything's ever happened. So I don't know if people got embarrassed or didn't want to participate or didn't like the direction. Today, we've got a new announcement. It's not an economic council. It's a very broad, and it's a
looks like council for recovery and growth.
But pretty broad. Economics is not a very focused part of that. And I personally think we need to have an economic solution and a pathway and some recommendations. What do you think of this announcement today? It is broad. There's a lot of great names on there. Is this going to satisfy people looking for an economic direction?
Well, I mean, for starters, yeah. Like, I mean, there's 28 names. Like, they run the gamut. They're people from all kinds of sectors, from like nonprofits to, I think there's one union representative there, to people in farming, fisheries, agriculture, aerospace, and biotech. So, you know, it's a broad group of people. It seems to lean towards kind of like smaller business owners. So, you know, it's not like Robert K. Irving and, Kevin Murphy or whatever. It seems to have come together in the last week. Most of the people I've talked to who were on this list were, you know, just got the invitation as of last week. So it seems a little reactive, I think, to some of the questions that have been coming from the opposition and maybe some of the media coverage, I don't know. It does sort of answer some of those criticisms, though, right? Like, because, you know, now we have the list, and, you know, they seems to be a decent group of people, very capable individuals. The question I guess I have is, like, you know, it's the mandate is pretty broad and pretty vague, and what is it that you need at this time? Like, can you realistically come up with some sort of massive industrial plan or comprehensive development plan type thing? When you don't know what's going to happen in a couple of months, like when everything is like still super uncertain and like the basics of the virus are still like a little, you know, sketchily known. So, those are questions I have. What should he do differently?
Well,
would have been cool to know this earlier, but you know, like,
but there is a committee. It's been established. They've got a mandate. I guess, Sam, here's a question for you. They don't really report back, I don't think, until August. This thing's moving pretty quick. I'm looking for a quick kind of, even if it's a wrong decision, at least you're making some directional change and providing some, guidance to government. Sam, do you think this is the right timetable for this kind of a crisis?
I don't know if the timetable is as much the issue as there's 28 people in it. I know you have to touch all walks of life, but there's a reason that a jury only has 12 people, or that when you're in a school project, you only have 3 or 4. 28 people, is my opinion, is way too many, and there's too many cooks in the kitchen at that point. That if there's 28 opinions, how are you going to concise all that into one or two distinct, let's do this? I just don't see that happening.
And the, me- they meet by Zoom. That's a difficult way to engage.
Right. Yeah. 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 And then there's supposed to be like some public consultation process to it as well. So, it seems it's probably going to play a bit of an advisory role, but I don't think this is the group that's necessarily kind of going to come up with like the expert plan on how to lead PEI out of the choppy economic waters of the pandemic.
And there isn't a perfect solution either. And we don't know if in 2 months that we're going to be shut down to zero all over again. So how are we supposed to adapt to that or mm-hmm. put a plan in place, because it's too hard. And I think the biggest thing when I read the announcements that 28 people is a lot of people, because there's some people, whether it's in bioscience, maybe their idea will have no good outcomes for someone in the tourism industry. Like it'd be clashing ideas. So I just think that maybe this is more of a, I don't know what you want to call it, like the big show that's saying, oh, we have this massive plan, but behind the scenes there's really four or five people that have the actual kind of fuel for the economic council or the advisory council.
I prefer to give like a bit of benefit of the doubt. I mean, like, they'll have their first meeting Friday, you know, probably a few of them might or might not talk to me. We'll see. But yeah, I mean, like it's possible a group like this might come up with, some decent policy recommendations. I'm thinking of, what was that report that was put out by UPEI a bunch of months ago? The one that was sort of about economic indicators. It's possible that like a broad group of people from different sectors in PEI can come up with some easy bullet points for recommendations for government. Like it could happen. Whether it's enough like for what we need to get out of this, like I don't know.
How long do you expect this session to last? Because I don't know, there hasn't been many sessions in the last year, but I expect this to probably be pretty short. Do you have any expectation?
Yeah, the word that I'm getting is that it's going to be about 2 to 3 days, probably go from Tuesday to Thursday. So it's emergency stuff only. So the government has sort of tabled these proposed amendments to the Emergency Measures Act, the Public Health Act, that would give them pretty broad powers to change existing legislation. They got to appoint like a child advocate, an auditor general, the privacy commission. So everybody took this year to retire, which is, kind of inconvenient timing, but, you know. What was the other thing? The Employment Standards Act. They basically have to introduce legislation that will allow sick leave for workers who need to quarantine, you know, for whatever reason. The budget is the thing that's not ready yet. Like, I think that's sort of what I think I was expecting at first when I thought of like an emergency sitting as like past budget. But I think that will take, they're not rushing that. I think they're going to take at least until late June until that's finished up. And you know, they're still doing the, contrary to what I think the Liberal third party are saying, there is still some consultation going on with the budget. Both parties are still meeting with government about what that's going to look like and what their asks are and what their demands are. But yeah, I mean, the interesting part, of course, would be the question period. I mean, like, these are like 2 months of like questions that have been sort of gestating inside of the gut of both of these parties. So, you know, I think we'll sort of have it out in the question period pretty well.
You know, a couple of days, these are big pieces of legislation. I'm not sure Iraq needs more powers, but anyway, we'll see how that goes. I'm really interested to see the Emergency Measures Act.
Yeah.
And, you know, these are sweeping, and I haven't looked at the act. I'm curious to get your thoughts on it, Stu, but, you know, taking away civil liberties and you know, having this power, and if it's not used during this period, and maybe we'll need it in the fall, is there a limit on that? You know, because it is a pretty powerful and dangerous piece of legislation. Other provinces are doing it. Do you think this will be a one for a lot of debate, discussion, or is it just going to get rammed through?
Well, they can't. I mean, they can't ram it through. They don't have a majority. I mean, they can't, like Alberta had a similar bill, I think, under the Kenny government, Bill 10 it was called, which was very similar. I think it might not have been quite as sweeping as what's being proposed here by King. But the idea was that they passed it. They went back to the legislature early in April, and it was sort of a reduced quorum. So I think the opposition MLAs didn't really know it was coming. And so they were kind of caught off guard, I think. So a similar piece of legislation was passed by the Kenny government. They took a lot of media heat for it. In this case, so the legislation, basically it allows any act essentially to be altered by cabinet, by executive council in a state of emergency. There's a similar change plan for states of public health emergency, which are slightly different. And that includes up to 90 days after the state of emergency ends. So the Greens have claimed that this is a brutal overreach of power, that it allows, like, you know, sort of sweeping powers of government, that the legislative assembly is essentially sort of swept aside. The government is sort of saying, well, when we needed to stop evictions from happening, we had to go to the Supreme Court. It was a huge bureaucratic hurdle. It's a bureaucratic hurdle every time that we even need somebody to, like, sign e-signature on like government documents, like even just little tweaks like that. And we've identified hundreds of little things in these Byzantine pieces of legislation that we got to change. So we need it for that purpose. I don't know what the liberals think of it. They've been a little coy. So we'll see. But still, I mean, you know, they need the government would need some support from one or the other party. I've heard that they might be changing their own legislation before it's introduced a little bit. I'm not sure exactly what that means, but it's a bizarre one. I mean, yeah, like it did seem a little broad. I'm surprised they sort of kind of put that out there as, you know.
And you know, it's not just for this government's risk. It could be a different government in at a different time with these same sweeping powers and legislation. It's, you know, it's...
I mean, one thing that I have heard sort of behind the scenes is, like, there were some consultations over this legislation. So both the opposition parties sort of knew it was coming. And so, like, it's not an accident that the Greens, of course, made noise the day it was posted online, right? Like, they of course, had the legislation before that. So, I mean, even though there's, like, some of this sort of consultative, collaborative stuff happening, I mean, there's still sort of politicking, like, as to what noise each party is making when stuff gets, like, made public.
So. I think the Greens have been forced to be quiet, like, the past 8, 9, 10 weeks. So any chance they got to chomp at the bit, they took it, and I don't blame them. That's politics.
Yeah, I mean, they didn't have to be as quiet as they were. I think, yeah, I mean, there were quite a few incidences, like, I mean, even some of this, I wrote a couple of stories that were, you know, I got called out for about the province's, like, testing practices. And I know that the Greens were looking into some of those same issues too, like about what capacity the island has to ramp up diagnostic testing and that sort of thing. But they kept quiet about that kind of thing, you know? So yeah, they did hold back, I think, for a long time. I think they could have, you know, raised some of these issues. But yeah, I mean, for the calculation was for the first month and a half of this whole thing that, like, you couldn't criticize any of the public health officials and you couldn't criticize government because they were putting the public health officials front and center. So,
anybody that you're disappointed in, Stu, or that you think really did exceptionally? You mentioned Matt McKay. You felt he had really performed well early on. Some ministers were a little bit more silent than others. Anything that kind of stood out as unusual or exceptional?
I mean, yeah, you got to talk about James Aylward. I mean, he's been completely absent, unlike most other health ministers in just about every other province. I mean, they're saying it's because they wanted Dr. Morrison to be front and center, the public face of the public health stuff. But yeah, I mean, it was a little bizarre how much he appeared to have been kind of kept in the background because of the whole quarantining once he returned.
But, you know, at the time, too, just to be a devil's advocate, really not many people knew the impacts, mm-hmm. the ramifications of the protocols.
I didn't really pursue this angle, but, I mean, there certainly were people like Rob Mitchell, you know, who are out of province and, you know, came back around that same week. Nobody was really asking the same question of Rob Mitchell, like, did you quarantine, you know, as soon as you came back? Not saying I'm suggesting otherwise it did happen, but, like, the questions weren't really asked of opposition either. Some of the sort of statements from the justice minister have been a little bizarre. I thought his announcements were fine about agri stability and sort of the money going into maintaining last week's crop of potatoes. Like, those are fine announcements. Like, you know, they make good policy. But like just sort of some comments, like when he claimed that there were two investigations around people jumping out of trailers, that are, like which turned out not to be true, was a little bizarre.
Yes.
I'll have more like bad things to say about people.
There'll probably be some more announcements that we can criticize down the road anyways. We appreciate your time, Stu. We won't keep you any longer. And we appreciate all you do for our Islanders and through the Guardian. We thank you for your time today.
Yeah, I mean, thanks for doing this, guys. I mean, like it's kind of a good addition to the media landscape in PEI. You know, I like what you guys are doing. So thanks for having me on.
Thank you.
Appreciate you being here. Thanks, Stu.
There was Stu Nepe, political reporter for The Guardian. We thank Stu again for his time. It's always a pleasure getting to talk to him and get his ear on what's happening at the legislature and beyond in PEI. As The Guardian would say, that they cover the island like they do, and Stu certainly does that as well.
Yeah, I mean, Stu is he's great to have on. He's certainly personable. He does have a lot of perspectives, and he's a well sought after political pundit. He's on a lot of different mediums we talked about, and now we've got him on The Exchange. And we're getting a lot of traction. We've had some great guests on. I mean, we've had people from Chad Rogers to Doug McLean to Alan Andrews, and every time our viewership and our listeners kind of increases exponentially. So great to have Stu into the mix.
I think maybe it's the more we have the good guests to kind of lure people in, but then our controversy and debatable topics maybe sink them in and make them listen to the next episode.
So what are you watching? Now, we are recording this after the second session of the legislature. There might not be much more than two more sessions, honestly. So what's your sense now? We've heard what Stu has to say. This was recorded just before the legislature sat. Do you have any sort of predictions, Sam, for the next?
I kind of figured, like, I knew collaboration was dead, like we talked about earlier, that there's no such thing anymore, that the Greens would start firing on all cylinders. And what I am actually surprised with is that the Liberals, how strong they're standing. So on Tuesday, the first...
Of course you are. Of course you are.
Yeah. So on Tuesday, the first sitting, usually on Tuesdays and Thursdays, the legislature sits from 2 to 5, and then again from 7 to 9. But they actually ended just around 8 o'clock on Tuesday, and so an hour early. And the reason for that was because...
Did the doctor pay?
No, there's no DACA pay. Well, maybe you could invoice them for your taxpayer percentage. But they closed because the Liberals wouldn't give them unanimous consent. So to bring more government business or to bring more bills to the floor, whether they're opposition in the Greens or government bills, you need an unanimous consent. And the Liberals did not give this. And maybe this is their way of saying, no, we're not just going to sit in the corner and take it. Like, we have a say, and we're gonna prove that point to you guys.
We're not just going to sit in the basement as a third party and just take it. You know, the collaboration, it probably was. What else could you do? It's strategic. It was the right thing to do coming in within a minority government. In fact, they were down one more seat, before they got to this legislative setting. So collaboration, maybe it was a buzzword. Maybe it was, just real intent on trying to collaborate. But that's over. And, I think maybe the Liberals took the first shot by filibustering and trying to delay procedures. But I'm pretty sure if the session went a little bit longer, and it's not going to, but it'll go long enough to see things start to break down before this is all over.
And like you said, like the same as rugby, you can fight all you want on the field, but once it's over, maybe shake each other's hands and go for a beer. But I do believe that even last year after the election, the kind of famous thing on CBC was that it was national news, actually, that the new premier, Dennis King, and leader of the opposition, Peter Bevan-Baker, were hugging after the election. Well, maybe they won't be hugging this time after the House is done sitting, if the premier keeps getting peppered by opposition questions.
Yeah, but they haven't gotten peppered. I think these are gentlemen that are legislatures. They're professionals. I think, if they get a few bruises in the legislature, I'm sure they'll get along well outside of the rail. And I'm sure they'll still work together to pass legislation that's good for Islanders. We're going to have some issues coming up. I think my sense of the economy, we're in a bit of a reprieve. We're going to have a couple of months where people are going to relax. We're going to enjoy the weather and then come back in once the fall hits, probably October, November. We're going to have a viral incidence, and the government will have to collaborate and agree to address those. There's going to be financial considerations. There's going to be big issues. So they'll have to get along. But nice to see a little bit of feistiness. You want to see that in question period.
Yeah, especially it creates news articles. So that'll probably be the headline in the newspaper the next couple of days, will be whatever was said in question period. So it's important to get that. It'll create more news for us to read. If you don't turn into the legislature, you're able to either listen to this podcast or you're able to see it on whether it's Twitter or whether it's on The Guardian or whatever the case may be. There is ways to get up to date on everything.
So give us a prediction, Sam. We've got at least two more days that we believe the House will be sitting before they adjourn. What's your prediction? Anything startling you think is going to really be remembered from this setting?
I don't think so. I think this is just a shut up and do your job for 3 days, and then we'll come back in the summer maybe. No, there's nothing like, obviously the Liberals and even the Greens trying to kind of slow down the process. It'll only go on so long because it'll backfire on the opposition for holding it up, because it'll make it seem like the Conservatives aren't able to govern. They aren't able to do their job in an emergency situation because the opposition is holding them up. So I don't think it'll last much longer. I don't think there'll be anything shocking from this. The only thing shocking maybe come from question period if someone embarrasses somebody. But so far, the government has done a pretty good job of deflecting questions, like you said.
And what about the Liberals? Are they going to choose a leader anytime, or are they just going to wait now until the pandemic settles?
I don't think there's any rush. I think we're switching gears to federal, but I think the federal Conservatives are kind of having a big issue with trying to pick a leader during a pandemic because all the dates are mixed up. And so I think the Liberals will probably wait at least until the fall to try to figure that out. But I don't know that for sure.
Well, you know, if Trudeau wasn't on TV all the time, maybe the Conservatives could get a little bit of airtime, but he's not really sharing any of that media spotlight. It's kind of like Trump.
I wouldn't want to share my airtime with Andrew Scheer either. So I don't know about you.
Fair enough. No comment, but yeah, walking wounded.
Yeah, so I think that'll probably wrap up today's episode, this week's, I should say. And we do have a potential guest on for next week, but we'll leave you hanging and make you stick around until next week to find that out.
Enjoy the legislature and enjoy the weather. Enjoy the economy opening up.
Let's hope for that too. So this has been another edition of The Exchange presented by Confederation Group. We'll see you next time.